Hello and welcome to this episode of The Upgrade. I'm your host, Peter Bittner, and today with me I have global futurist and CEO of Silicon Humanism, Sylvia Galliser. Thank you so much for joining me, Sylvia.
Thank you, Peter. Such a delight to be here with you today.
Yeah, I appreciate your time. I'm really looking forward to hearing about your journey in futurism and all things AI. I first really sort of came across you on LinkedIn when I noticed that you were also teaching at UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism, where I'm an alumni and have also taught in new media. So first of all, that's super cool. Second of all, how did you get that awesome gig and what were you up to there?
Thank you for asking. Actually, you know that the funny thing, you spend so much time sometimes like giving podcast interviews and conferences online, and suddenly out of nowhere, somebody like listen to that and reach out to you and say, hey, we're looking for a speaker. So that's really how it happened to me. They reach out to me on a contact form on my website, and we started discussing with this wonderful teacher at Berkeley about a group coming from Europe and interested into having some introduction to generative AI and what are the potential impacts and ethical consequences on the profession of journalists. So that's how it started. And I got lucky to kind of be now replicating that workshops a few times with different groups. So yeah, it's a really exciting area. Also, I know like some journalists are very skeptical about it. So we try to really see like full range of potential consequences. It's not just everything is perfect or everything is doomed. It's really about like seeing, making some nuances and seeing what could be the potential.
I want to dig into that as well. But first, I want to hear more about your background. I understand that you've studied economics and business and are an entrepreneur.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for asking. Yeah, actually, I started my career in Europe. I was really interested actually in journalism for a while. So I did a business school, but applied management to media. I worked for public radio and television in France, and also for a private television in France called Canal Plus. And then I had the, let's say, amazing opportunity to move abroad with the French embassy to become actually a media analyst. And somehow I stayed in San Francisco for more than the 2 years of contract I had at first. I married someone who was studying at Berkeley by then, which was a fun story as well.
Very good.
And I stayed in international trade and mentoring startup for almost 15 years. And we always look for short-term return on investment. Like startups weren't looking much more than 2-3 years ahead. And I was like, what if I could look like ahead, like realigned founders with their mission, with their long-term vision? So I started studying strategic foresight or future thinking or futurism. And I became a certified professional futurist with EFTF. IFTF is the Institute for the Future in Palo Alto. I have also my own company, which is called Silicon Humanism. And as we were just mentioning, sometimes I work with group of professionals interested in new technology to see what could be the impact on the long term. And when we say long term, it's usually like 5 to 15 to 20 to 30 years. So these are more the horizon we're looking at here.
Right. That's far beyond the typical scope of corporate or, you know, certainly the news cycle, right, which is incredibly short, right, famously. Tell me about, you know, what that certification process consisted of and how does one study futurism or become a futurist?
Absolutely. So that's really fascinating because today there are more options to become a futurist than a few years ago. But either you can do it right in college. You have different programs like that. In Europe, you have Copenhagen and so on. So you can go directly in grad school and learn that type of program, which I think is a really great way for young people to get into future thinking. Or you can do it kind of second career path, I would say. You start with a career maybe in design or in economics. And at some point, you feel like you're a future thinker, like in your everyday life, you already think a lot about the future. And you would like just to get some kind of certification and start working with a community of futurists. And the community is so active. There are plenty of opportunities to collaborate and so on. So that's what I did, like after my career more in startup mentoring. I was interested in really like doing that type of certification. So IFTF offers an online course on Coursera. They also do a lot of in-person workshops. I would recommend either of those, but that's a really great way to get into future thinking on a professional level.
And tell me as well, because I'm pretty new to this term. Really, it's only in the last year or two where I've encountered a number of futurists just across, you know, LinkedIn, where I'm also quite active and find to be very useful to meet new people adjacent to kind of the new media and AI and tech space. And so I think that is a really fascinating lens to view the world. Like, how are those futurists, like, is that a consultant title typically? Is there in-house futurists?
That's a great question. And I wish there would be more futurists to help the world move forward towards better futures. Today, the community starts to be quite big and you see different types of profile. Coming more from academics, you have researchers, like futures researchers, who work either in academic settings or in research settings. The second you see is a lot of consultants, either freelance or let's say small practices, like small companies, startups or freelancing, which was more like my case. Then you have larger communities like Association of Professional Futurists. I'm also like working a lot with them. I was leading their think tank dedicated to ethics of the futures. And then you have a few in-house futurists in big corporations, which I know I'm sometimes a bit jealous of, because you can imagine like working for Lego or McDonald's or Volkswagen and be like their entitled futurist. But not so many companies have that direct title or that direct position available today. So most of the time you start working like freelancing, giving workshops, sometimes supporting the executive board to launch their strategic year, help them think in the longer term future. So yeah, it's quite diverse.
Excellent. Tell me, as a futurist, how do you view this moment of generative AI revolution, as you've called it in some of your writing?
I have to say that's been quite one of the most challenging time for me and for a lot of futurists. Like the fact that you see the future force happening right in front of your eyes and you try to grasp it and understand what could be the long-term consequences in all the dimensions, like social, technological, of course, but also political, geopolitical at some point, ethical, and also the impact on the environment is also a big aspect of it. So we try to really see in all those dimensions how things are changing. And maybe I should mention here that futurists have kind of a raw material that they study every day that we call signals of the future. And the idea is really, in all the noise that you can see, in all the news that you read every day or you listen to, like, what are these nuggets, like these signals of the future that if you interpret them will help you kind of foresee what the future could be like?
Yeah, it's really difficult to keep up with everything, and sorting the signal from the noise is always a challenge. Do you have any signals that you've really honed in on in terms of trends or things that we should really be thinking about as the media landscape evolves, in particular with this generative AI transformation?
I mean, definitely when ChatGPT was launched in November 2022, for me, that really is a trigger, like an interface available for everyone. That was really the start of something. I would say like a lot of other signals are the behaviors, how people are changing their behaviors, like jobs. For example, I think it was Netflix or another company was trying to hire a prompt engineer and it was paid almost $1 million. I think it was $900,000 a year. And that was another signal about like trying to understand how the market is changing. And what's happening is also a lot of jobs are being created, and executive in charge of AI apparently has become like the new hype title from an article of the New York Times. And the New York Times themselves, after having sued OpenAI, is now hiring an AI team. So I think all this change is really interesting as to going from resistance to really like taking the change as part of what is going to be as part of their strategy.
So what are some of the ways in which you think journalism will be transformed by generative AI, or already is in some cases?
in media and creativity in general, we see the possibility to focus on new type of content, reduction in labor costs, productivity costs, and so on. I think for the news industry in particular, there's an additional component that makes things a bit more complex. It's all our relationship to truth and the trust that news corporations try to build with their audience is really at play. And for example, a few topics that I like to mention is first, like the one that comes to mind is really the scraping of journalist work. Like journalists have been doing a wonderful job and sometimes really risking their lives to produce really high quality content. But that's the very same content that is in the training data set of those LLMs today. And that's a real issue for journalists to feel that they are robbed of their ad value. So that's one topic. Another topic, and it's a different one, it's really around like authorship and copyright of the output. Okay, now that those systems produce an output and I can put that content maybe in a newsletter, in an article, like who should I dedicate that work to? Like who should it be attributed to? Should I mention like the system, if I've been working with Copilot, for example, should I mention like all the sources that have been included? So that's a real question. Another question, a very, very big one, a fundamental one, is bias and the perpetuation of bias throughout the systems. Because the systems, as much as we want them to be neutral, they cannot be because data available on internet today, which is the training data, is biased. So by working on those systems, you reproduce those bias. And the last one, which I think is really interesting, and at first when I was working with journalists, the question was more about like having hands-on workshop, questioning ethical practices. But more and more, the people I'm working with are not the journalists, but the bosses of the journalists. It's more about leadership. Like, how do you lead in this new era when all your workforce is working with AI tools? What is the role of a supervisor in that type of setting? How is leadership going to evolve in the era of AI? I think it's a super interesting question and one that we need to address.
Hey there, are you enjoying this episode? If so, you might be interested in my live online training courses and consulting services. Visit theupgrade.ai to learn more. I'd love to help you and your organization get up to speed on AI. You brought up a lot of really critical points already, you know, that are very contentious, and you know, this is such a quickly evolving and changing landscape. But I think that with the genesis of generative AI tools, suddenly everyone essentially has a writing assistant and a research assistant. And so the standard of output and quality in some ways could really expand and be raised, right? But also, on the other hand, it's harder to cut through the noise of the internet now, which is being flooded already with all this other AI generated content, much of it which is very low quality but is, you know, packed with those keywords that will develop more engagement and click-throughs. And so this entire dynamic of production and distribution and access of online information is just really in flux here, and it's difficult to see what's going to happen.
And you know what, when you see articles produced by generative AI being almost copy-pasted as new articles, and then that put that type of content on top of the content on Google search or whatever, and at some point, like, fake content is amplified until you don't even listen to what was the initial truth. Some bad content can be like completely amplified. And that's where we need to make sure like we keep some safeguards here.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of unknown unknowns, right, in this new world where there's edge cases we haven't really anticipated yet. I really want to discuss deepfakes with you. We've seen some incidents in recent months as, you know, these tools for both image generation and video generation have been improving so rapidly, right? Tom Hanks, Hoda from the Today Show, their images had been used in advertisements for products they had no affiliation with, right, without their consent. And this is, you know, really the tip of the iceberg, I think, in many ways. And I'd love to get your reaction to this.
So I would say, first of all, I'm in a sense kind of surprised that it took so long to happen, because somehow we forecasted this almost at the start of deepfakes, and I'm not happy that it happens, but I feel we need to hear about that so that people get aware of what is happening, that it can happen to any of them. And that's what we need to make sure, that a lot of individuals who cannot defend themselves might get the same kind of abuse of their personal life, of their personal image, of their identity. And that's a real problem. So that's why we need to have regulation evolve. So for example, in the US, there's this Artificial Intelligence Fake Replicas and Unauthorized Duplication Act that's been discussed for already a while. And I think there are three very important aspects in that act. The first one is really about reaffirming that everyone's likeness and voice is protected. It's really giving individuals the right to control the use of their identifying characteristics. The second one is empowering individuals to enforce that right against those who could help facilitate this, like the technology, without their permission. And the third aspect, which I think is probably a bit touchy, but really, really important to me, is also about balancing the rights against the First Amendment protections to safeguard speech and innovation. And there's really a fine balance. You know, Kant, the philosopher Kant, was saying, like, the freedom of yourself is limited by the freedom of others. So I'm really thankful to see that there's some effort at the regulatory level in that direction. Also in Europe, the AI Act is also something that's finally agreed on. It has taken a while in the negotiation to find its way. But I think it's also trying to really finally balance innovation versus protection. It's like a cat and mouse game, you know, between countermeasures and then countermeasures. And for example, you have already deep fake detectors, not as good as they could be, but they are really improving. McAfee announced his AI-powered deepfake audio detection technology. So the idea is really that every time that technology is taken back by hackers or by bad actors, they also like take a lot of their resources to combat that bad use of technology. So I really think in the long term, it's going to evolve until maybe at some point you have something like an anti-spam system, antivirus system. You'll be able to detect every time you see a video, you'll have a full rating, like how much has been AI created, how much has been human reviewed, how much has been fact checked. That's really the way the battle against misinformation is going forward. So also a lot of social platforms are now trying to disclaim when the content is too much viral. You need to double check. Did you click on that article before you liked it? And so on. And same, like Google just filed this patent application for an AI-based system that detects information operations campaigns on social media. And I have to say that in election year in the US, in other parts of the world as well, it's really important that we put in place such tools to be able to identify what is real content and what is manipulative content.
Of course, yeah, it's a critical year to get a handle and really define the policy framework quickly. I'm curious, you know, to hear a little bit about your frameworks that you've been working on and applying in terms of these different types of deepfake actors and this really complex ecosystem that all needs to be taken account to balance things like the right to, you know, free speech here in the US, for example.
So what I really want to highlight when we talk about deepfakes, it's not like throwing everything in trash. It's really about like including nuances, understanding different type of possible use cases. So what I like to do usually is introduce a framework which is not too different as the framework we can use for general cyber policing or the way we moderate social media today or even ethics in the metaverse and so on. The first step is really about identifying different clusters or different segments of actors. You have clearly some agents with malevolent intentions, hackers, scammers, cyber criminals, you name it. Sometimes they ask for ransom, or they look to destroy your reputation online, or to conduct propaganda or misinformation at some scale, or even terrorize population. So that's where we need to put a lot of effort and attention. Now we need also to identify how much that segment represents and that it's not all the segments, it's just one of them. Then you have a category of players, which is more what I call like the ruthless or the uncaring actors. They believe it's fun to play with the technology. And I'm thinking here like deepfakes of the Pope or Donald Trump or Tom Hanks and so on. But at some point, those players like with the technology don't fully consider how it can serve misinformation and have a deep impact. And that's why like futurists need to disentangle what it could mean for the future, what could be the concrete impact of creating a new video with Drake and The Weeknd, what is the impact on copyright, how the music industry is going to reply to that, or generating a deep fake of global leaders threatening nuclear attacks without thinking about what it means in terms of international diplomacy, like what if it's taken seriously and has real consequences. And that's an important aspect of deepfakes, is the fact that something fake can have real life consequences. Then there's what I kind of call the gray zone. You don't necessarily mean bad, but it happens that the consequences can be very bad for some players. I'm thinking like we've seen a lot of companies just because their competitors would develop something with AI, they reach out to management consulting firms and they ask, okay, we want to do something with AI, whatever that is, like everybody's doing it, we want to dedicate a budget to that and so on. So the company jumps on the bandwagon and without redeveloping the use case thoroughly enough and carefully enough. So what happens is that along the process, they don't protect their data enough or they reproduce institutionalized bias because they don't care enough about the type of data they're using. So it's really important that we don't forget that type of use cases because there might be actually a very, very big segment. And then you have unintended consequences. It's really like you mean good, like you want to do something good, but as a consequence, bad happens. And I'm thinking of a lot of artists accepting to deepfake their image or performance saying, okay, maybe there's an opportunity here instead of just not wanting my image deepfaked. I'm okay with that, but I want a remuneration against that. So you would think it's smart, and I'm sure at some point it is a smart way to kind of deal with that type of situation. Except that, okay, imagine that tomorrow, like Tom Cruise or whichever actor starts to get this generalized deepfakes and can be in 10 or 15 movies in 1 year instead of just the exceptional movie of the year. What does it say about his value on the market? Like, it's not the exceptional Tom Cruise movie of the year. It's just like an inflation on the digital identity of the actor himself. Or imagine, like, it can be the same with a song. Like, you just give the right to your voice and then, like, tons and tons of songs. You get money on it, but like nobody wants to listen to Taylor Swift all day long, or maybe people do.
They probably still do. But I think that there's a great point you're making in that when suddenly you're not limited as a creator, right, in terms of your ability to like physically manifest either your voice or image right across these mediums, it does potentially, you know, open up some other avenues for revenue generation, but also the inflation aspect. That's fascinating. And something that here to now was not even something that I had ever considered, right? But that's a really interesting point.
In terms of impact on economics, I think there's a lot here to identify in terms of new business models, but not just the immediate business models, but the long-term consequences. Like in what future are we going to live if every creator is now able to duplicate themselves in the future.
Well, Sylvia, where can people find you? Where can they learn about your work and read your writing?
Thank you, Peter. It was really a pleasure to have this conversation. And of course, for those who want to continue the conversation, feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn. My name is Sylvia Galusser, 2L, 2S. I know sometimes there are mistakes on this, but I'm still the one and unique Sylvia Galusser until I'm cloned myself. Also, my company, Silicon Humanism, is also available like on LinkedIn. I have a blog. We recently launched a newsletter for the younger futurists who are interested in developing a career in futurism or just maybe know more about what this means to be a futurist. So every week we share signals of the future. We ask big questions. We give you a taste of the future. We push some envisioning exercises here. And thank you so much for having me here today.
Pleasure is all mine. Yeah, I really appreciate you sharing your perspective. And I love your newsletter. I encourage people to go subscribe right now and go follow you on LinkedIn as well, Sylvia.
Thank you, Peter.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure you don't miss the next one. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Want to help others discover the Upgrade Pod? Please consider leaving a 5-star rating and sharing this episode with your friends and colleagues. You can see a full list of episodes on theupgrade.ai, where you can also learn about our AI training courses and consulting services. By the way, I'm always looking for new people to come on the show. Want to become my next guest? Have an idea for someone you'd like me to interview? Visit theupgrade.ai, where you can nominate yourself or others to come on the show. Special thanks this week to Levi Bridges for production help. Until next time, stay calm and keep upgrading.